What broke his paralysis was both simple and unexpected. About 10 paces from the base of Jonesy's tree, the man in the brown coat fell down. Jonesy heard the pained, surprised sound he made. "Oh," was what it sounded like. And his finger released the trigger without his even thinking about it. The man was down on his hands and knees, his brown-gloved fingers, brown gloves, another mistake. This guy could almost have gone out with a sign reading "Shoot Me" taped to his back, Jonesy thought, spread on the ground, which had already begun to whiten. As the man got up again, he began to speak aloud in a fretful, wondering voice. Jonesy didn't realize at first that he was also weeping. "Oh, dear. Oh, dear," the man said as he worked his way back to a standing position. He swayed on his feet as if drunk. Jonesy knew that men in the woods, men away from their families for a week or a weekend, got up to all sorts of small wickedness. Drinking at 10 in the morning was one of the most common. But Jonesy didn't think this guy was drunk. No reason, just a vibe. "Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear." And then, as he began to walk again, "Snow. Now it's snow. Please, God. Oh, God, now it's snow. Oh, dear." His first couple of steps were lurching and unsure. Jonesy had about decided that his vibe was incorrect. The guy was loaded. And then the fellow's gait smoothed out, and he began to walk a little more evenly. He was scratching at his right cheek. He passed directly beneath the stand. For a moment, he wasn't a man at all, but only a round circle of orange cap with brown shoulders to either side of it. His voice drifted up, liquid and full of tears, mostly "oh dear," with the occasional "oh God," or "now it's snow" thrown in for salt. Jonesy stood where he was, watching as the guy first disappeared directly beneath the stand, then came out on the other side. He pivoted without being aware of it to keep the plotting man in view, nor was he aware that he had lowered his rifle to his side, even pausing long enough to put the safety back on. Jonesy didn't call out, and he supposed he knew why, simple guilt. He was afraid that the man down there would take one look at him and see the truth in Jonesy's eyes. Even through his tears and the thickening snow, the man would see that Jonesy had been up there with his gun pointed, that Jonesy had almost shot him. 20 paces beyond the tree, the man stopped and only stood there, his gloved right hand raised to his brow, shielding his eyes from the snow. Jonesy realized he had seen hole in the wall, had probably realized he was on an actual path, too. "Oh, dear," and "oh, God," stopped, and the guy began to run toward the sound of the generator, rocking from side to side like a man on the deck of a ship. Jonesy could hear the stranger's short, sharp gasps for breath as he pounded toward the roomy cabin with the lazy curl of smoke rising from the chimney and fading almost at once into the snow. Jonesy began to work his way down the rungs nailed to the trunk of the maple, with his gun slung over his shoulder. The thought that the man might present some sort of danger did not occur to him, not then. He simply didn't want to leave the Garand, which was a fine gun, out in the snow. His hip had stiffened, and by the time he got to the foot of the tree, the man he'd almost shot had made it nearly all the way to the cabin door, which was unlocked, of course. No one locked up, not way out here. About 10 feet from the granite slab that served as hole-in-the-wall's front stoop, the man in the brown coat and orange hat fell down again. His hat tumbled off, revealing a sweaty clump of thinning brown hair. He stayed on one knee for a moment, head lowered. Jonesy could hear his harsh, fast breathing. The man picked up his cap, and just as he set it back on his head, Jonesy hailed him. The man staggered to his feet and turned tipsily. Jonesy's first impression was that the man's face was very long, that he was almost what people meant when they called someone horse-faced. Then, as Jonesy got closer, hitching a little, but not really limping, and that was good because the ground underfoot was getting slippery fast, he realized the guy's face wasn't particularly long at all. He was just very scared and very, very pale. The red patch on his cheek where he had been scratching stood out brightly. The relief that came over him when he saw Jonesy hurrying toward him was large and immediate. Jonesy almost laughed at himself standing up there on the platform in the tree and worrying about the guy reading his eyes. This man wasn't into reading faces, and he clearly had no interest in where Jonesy had come from or what he might have been doing. This man looked like he wanted to throw his arms around Jonesy's neck and cover him with big, gooey kisses. "Thank God," the man cried. He held out one hand toward Jonesy and shuffled toward him through the thin icing of new snow. "Oh, gee, thank God, I'm lost. I've been lost in the woods since yesterday. I thought I was going to die out here. I... His feet slipped, and Jonesy grabbed his upper arms. He was a big man, taller than Jonesy, who stood 6'2", and broader as well. Nevertheless, Jonesy's first impression was of insubstantialness, as if the man's fear had somehow scooped him out and left him light as a milkweed pod. "Easy, fella," Jonesy said. "Easy, you're all right now, you're okay. Let's just get you inside and get you warm. How would that be?" As if the word warm had been his cue, the man's teeth began to chatter. Sure. He tried to smile without much success. Jonesy was again struck by his extreme pallor. It was cold out here this morning, upper 20s at best, but the guy's cheeks were all ashes and lead. The only color in his face, other than the red patch, were the brown crescents under his eyes. Jonesy got an arm around the man's shoulders, suddenly swept by an absurd and sappy tenderness for this stranger, an emotion so strong it was like his first junior high school crush. Mary Jo Martineau, in a sleeveless white blouse and straight knee-length denim skirt. He was now absolutely sure the man hadn't been drinking. It was fear, and maybe exhaustion, rather than booze that had made him unsteady on his feet. Yet there was a smell on his breath, something like bananas. It reminded Jonesy of the ether he'd sprayed into the carburetor of his first car, a Vietnam-era Ford, to get it to crank over on cold mornings. "Get you inside, right?"
"Yeah, cold. Thank God you came along. Is this
my place?"
"No, a friend's."
Jonesy opened the varnished oak door and helped the man over the threshold. The stranger gasped at the feel of the warm air, and a flush began to rise in his cheeks. Jonesy was relieved to see there was some blood in him after all. Hole in the Wall was pretty grand by Deep Woods standards. You came in on the single big downstairs room, kitchen, dining room, and living room all in one, but there were two bedrooms behind it, and another upstairs under the single eave. The big room was filled with the scent of pine and its mellow, varnished glow. There was a Navajo rug on the floor and a Mi'kmaq hanging on one wall which depicted brave little stick hunters surrounding an enormous bear. A plain oak table, long enough to accommodate eight places, defined the dining area. There was a wood stove in the kitchen and a fireplace in the living area. When both were going, the place made you feel stupid with the heat, even if it was 20 below outside. The west wall was all window, giving a view of the long, steep slope which fell off to the west. There had been a fire there in the 70s, and the dead trees stood black and twisted in the thickening snow. Jonesy, Pete, Henry, and the Beeve called this slope the Gulch, because that's what the Beeve's dad and his friends had called it.
"Oh, God. Thank God, and thank you, too," the man in the orange hat said to Jonesy.
And when Jonesy grinned, that was a lot of thank yous, the man laughed shrilly as if to say yes, he knew it. It was a funny thing to say, but he couldn't help it. He began to take deep breaths, for a few moments looking like one of those exercise gurus you saw on High Number Cable. On every exhale, he talked.
"God, I really thought I was done for last night. It was so cold, and the damp air, I remember that. Remember thinking, oh boy, oh dear, what if there's snow coming after all? I got coughing and couldn't stop. Something came and I thought I have to stop coughing. If that's a bear or something, I'll, you know, provoke it or something. Only I couldn't, and after a while it just, you know, went away on its own."
"You saw a bear in the night?" Jonesy was both fascinated and appalled. He had heard there were bears up here. Old man Goslin and his pickle barrel buddies at the store loved to tell bear stories, particularly to out-of-staters. But the idea that this man, lost and on his own, had been menaced by one in the night was keenly horrible. It was like hearing a sailor talk about a sea monster. I don't know that it was, the man said, and suddenly shot Jonesy a sidewards look of cunning that Jonesy didn't like and couldn't read.
I can't say for sure. By then there was no more lightning.
Lightning, too? Man! If not for the guy's obviously genuine distress, Jonesy would have wondered if he wasn't getting his leg pulled. In truth, he wondered it a little anyway.
Dry lightning, I guess, the man said.
Jonesy could almost see him shrugging it off. He scratched at the red place on his cheek, which might have been a touch of frostbite.
See it in winter, it means there's a storm on the way.
And you saw this? Last night?
I guess so.
The man gave him another quick sideways glance, but this time Jonesy saw no slyness in it, and guessed he had seen none before. He saw only exhaustion.
It's all mixed up in my mind. My stomach's been hurting ever since I got lost. It always hurts when I'm scared, ever since I was a little kid.
And he was like a little kid, Jonesy thought, looking everywhere at once with perfect unselfconsciousness. Jonesy led the guy toward the couch in front of the fireplace, and the guy let himself be led. A scared. He even said a scared instead of afraid, like a kid. A little kid. Give me your coat, Jonesy said. And as the guy first unbuttoned the buttons and then reached for the zipper under them, Jonesy thought again of how he had thought he was looking at a deer. At a buck, for Christ's sakes. He had mistaken one of those buttons for an eye and had damned near put a bullet through it. The guy got the zipper halfway down, and then it stuck, one side of the little gold mouth choking on the cloth. He looked at it, gawked at it, really, as if he had never seen such a thing before. And when Jonesy reached for the zipper, the man dropped his hands to his side and simply let Jonesy reach, as a first grader would stand and let the teacher put matters right when he got his galoshes on the wrong feet or his jacket on inside out. Jonesy got the little gold mouth started again and pulled it the rest of the way down. Outside the window wall, the gulch was disappearing, although you could still see the black scrawled shapes of the trees. Almost 30 years they had come up here together for the hunting, almost 30 years without a single miss, and in none of that time had there been snow heavier than the occasional squall. It looked like all that was about to change, although how could you tell? These days the guys on radio and TV made 4 inches of fresh powder sound like the next ice age. For a moment, the guy only stood there with his jacket hanging open and snow melting around his boots on the polished wooden floor, looking up at the rafters with his mouth open, and yes, he was like a great big 6-year-old, or like Duddits. You almost expected to see mittens dangling from the cuffs of his jacket on clips. He shrugged out of his coat in that perfectly recognizable child's way, simply slumping his shoulders once it was unzipped and letting it fall. If Jonesy hadn't been there to catch it, it would have gone on the floor and gotten right to work sopping up the puddles of melting snow. "What's that?" he asked. For a moment, Jonesy had no idea what the guy was talking about, and then he traced the stranger's gaze to the bit of weaving which hung from the center rafter. It was colorful, red and green with shoots of canary yellow as well, and it looked like a spider web. "It's a dream catcher," Jonesy said. "The Indian charm. Supposed to keep the nightmares away, I guess." "Is it yours?" Jonesy didn't know if he meant the whole place. Perhaps the guy hadn't been listening before, or just the dream catcher. But in either case, the answer was the same. "No, my friends, we come up hunting every year."
"How many of you?"
The man was shivering, holding his arms crisscrossed over his chest and cupping his elbows in his palms as he watched Jonesy hang his coat on the tree by the door.
4. Beaver, this is his camp, is out hunting now. I don't know if the snow will bring him back in or not. Probably it will. Pete and Henry went to the store. Goslin's, that one? Uh-huh. Come on over here and sit down on the couch."
Jonesy led him to the couch, a ridiculously long sectional. Such things had gone out of style decades ago, but it didn't smell too bad and nothing had infested it. Style and taste didn't matter much at Hole in the Wall.
"Stay put now," he said, and left the man sitting there, shivering and shaking with his hands clasped between his knees.
His jeans had the sausagey look they get when there are long johns underneath, and still he shook and shivered. But the heat had brought on an absolute flood of color. Instead of looking like a corpse, the stranger now looked like a diphtheria victim. Pete and Henry were doubling in the bigger of the two downstairs bedrooms. Jonesy ducked in, opened the cedar chest to the left of the door, and pulled out one of the two down comforters folded up inside. As he recrossed the living room to where the man sat shivering on the couch, Jonesy realized he hadn't asked the most elementary question of all, the one even six-year-olds who couldn't get their own zippers down asked. As he spread the comforter over the stranger on the outsized camp couch, he said, "What's your name?" and realized he almost knew. "McCoy, McCann." The man Jonesy had almost shot looked up at him, at once pulling the comforter up around his neck. The brown patches under his eyes were filling in purple. "McCarthy," he said. "Richard McCarthy." His hand, surprisingly plump and white without its glove, crept out from beneath the coverlet like a shy animal. "You are?" "Gary Jones," he said, and took the hand with the one which had almost pulled the trigger. "Folks mostly call me Jonesy." "Thanks, Jonesy." McCarthy looked at him earnestly. "I think you saved my life." "Oh, I don't know about that," Jonesy said. He looked at that red patch again. Frostbite, just a small patch. Frostbite. Had to be. Chapter 2. The Beeve. "You know I can't call anyone, don't you?" Jonesy said. "The phone lines don't come anywhere near here. There's a Jenny for the electric, but that's all." McCarthy, only his head showing above the comforter, nodded. "I was hearing the generator, but you know how it is when you're lost. Noises are funny. Sometimes the sound seems to be coming from your left or your right. Then you'd swear it's behind you and you better turn back." Jonesy nodded, although he did not in fact know how it was. Unless you counted the week or so immediately after his accident, time he had spent wandering in a fog of drugs and pain, he had never been lost. "I'm trying to think what'd be the best thing," Jonesy said. "I guess when Pete and Henry get back, we better take you out. How many in your party?" It seemed McCarthy had to think. That, added to the unsteady way he had been walking, solidified Jonesy's impression that the man was in shock. He wondered that one night lost in the woods would do that. He wondered if it would do it to him. "Four," McCarthy said, after that minute to think. "Just like you guys. We were hunting in pairs. I was with a friend of mine, Steve Otis. He's a lawyer like me down in Skowhegan. We're all from Skowhegan, you know. And this week, for us, it's a big deal." Jonesy nodded, smiling. "Yeah, same here. Anyway, I guess I just wandered off." He shook his head. "I don't know. I was hearing Steve over on my right, sometimes seeing his vest through the trees, and then I just don't know. I got thinking about stuff, I guess. One thing the woods are great for is thinking about stuff, and then I was on my own. I guess I tried to backtrack, but then it got dark." He shook his head yet again. "It's all mixed up in my mind, but yeah, there were four of us. I guess that's one thing I'm sure of. Me and Steve and Nat Roper and Nat's sister, Becky. They must be worried sick." McCarthy looked first startled, then apprehensive. This was clearly a new idea for him. "Yeah, they must be. Of course they are. Oh, dear. Oh, gee." Jonesy had to restrain a smile at this. When he got going, McCarthy sounded a little like a character in that movie Fargo. "So we better take you out, if that is, I don't want to be a bother." "We'll take you out if we can. I mean, this weather came in fast." "It sure did," McCarthy said bitterly. "You'd think they could do better with all their darn satellites and Doppler radar and gosh knows what else. So much for fair and seasonably cold, huh?" Jonesy looked at the man under the comforter, just the flushed face and the thatch of thinning brown hair showing, with some perplexity. The forecasts he had heard, he, Pete, Henry, and the Beeve, had been full of the prospect of snow for the last 2 days. Some of the prognosticators hedged their bets, saying the snow could change over to rain, but the fellow on the Castle Rock radio station that morning, WCAS was the only radio that could get up here, and even that was thin and jumbled with static, had been talking about a fast-moving Alberta clipper, 6 or 8 inches, and maybe a nor'easter to follow if the temperatures stayed down and the low didn't go out to sea. Jonesy didn't know where McCarthy had gotten his weather forecasts, but it sure hadn't been WCAS. The guy was just mixed up, that was most likely it, and had every right to be. "You know, I could put on some soup. How would that be, Mr. McCarthy?" McCarthy smiled gratefully. "I think that would be pretty fine," he said. "My stomach hurt last night and something fierce this morning, but I feel better now." "Stress?" Jonesy said. "I would have been puking my guts, probably filling my pants as well." "I didn't throw up," McCarthy said. "I'm pretty sure I didn't, but..." Another shake of the head. It was like a nervous tic with him. "I don't know. The way things are jumbled, it's like a nightmare I had." "Nightmare's over," Jonesy said. He felt a little foolish saying such a thing, a little anti-ish, but it was clear the guy needed reassurance. "Good," McCarthy said. "Thank you. And I would like some soup. There's tomato, chicken, and I think maybe a can of chunky sirloin. What do you fancy?" "Chicken," McCarthy said. "My mother always said chicken soup was the thing when you're not feeling your best." He grinned as he said it, and Jonesy tried to keep the shock off his face. McCarthy's teeth were white and even, really too even to be anything but capped, given the man's age, which had to be 45 or thereabouts. But at least 4 of them were missing. The canines on top, what Jonesy's father had called the vampire teeth, and 2 right in front on the bottom. Jonesy didn't know what those were called. He knew one thing, though. McCarthy wasn't aware they were gone. No one who knew about such gaps in the line of his teeth could expose them so unselfconsciously, even under circumstances like these, or so Jonesy believed. He felt a sick little chill rush through his gut, a telephone call from nowhere. He turned toward the kitchen before McCarthy could see his face change and wonder what was wrong. Maybe ask what was wrong. "One order chicken soup coming right up. How about a grilled cheese to go with it? If it's no trouble. And call me Richard, will you? Or Rick, that's even better. When people save my life, I like to get on a first-name basis with them as soon as possible. Rick it is, for sure." "Better get those teeth fixed before you step in front of another jury, Rick." The feeling that something was wrong here was very strong. It was that click, just as almost guessing McCarthy's name had been. He was a long way from wishing he'd shot the man when he had the chance, but he was already starting to wish McCarthy had stayed the hell away from his tree and out of his life. He had the soup on the stove and was making the cheese sandwiches when the first gust of wind arrived, a big whoop that made the cabin creak and raised the snow in a furious sheet. For a moment, even the black scrawled shapes of the trees in the gulch were erased, and there was nothing outside the big window but white. It was as if someone had set up a drive-in movie screen out there. For the first time, Jonesy felt a thread of unease not just about Pete and Henry, presumably on their way back from Goslin's in Henry's scout, but for the beaver. He would have said that if anybody knew these woods, it would have been the beeve, but nobody knew anything in a whiteout. All bets were off. That was another of his ne'er-do-well father's sayings. Probably not as good as "you can't make yourself be lucky," but not bad. The sound of the jenny might help beeve find his way, but as McCarthy had pointed out, sounds had a way of deceiving you, especially if the wind started kicking up, as it had now apparently decided to do. His mom had taught him the dozen basic things he knew about cooking, and one of them had to do with the art of making grilled cheese sandwiches. "Lay in a little mouse turds first," she said, mouse turds being Janet Jones's for mustard, "and then butter the goddamn bread, not the skillet. Butter the skillet, and all's you got's fried bread with some cheese in it." He had never understood how the difference between where you put the butter, on the bread or in the skillet, could change the ultimate result, but he always did it his mother's way, even though it was a pain in the ass buttering the tops of the sandwiches while the bottoms cooked. No more would he have left his rubber boots on once he was in the house, because, his mother had always said, "they draw your feet." He had no idea just what that meant, but even now, as a man going on 40, he took his boots off as soon as he was in the door, so they wouldn't draw his feet. "I think I might have one of these babies myself," Jonesy said. and laid the sandwiches in the skillet, butter side down. The soup had begun to simmer, and it smelled fine, like comfort.
"Good idea. I certainly hope your friends are all right."
"Yeah," Jonesy said. He gave the soup a stir.
"Where's your place?"
"Well, we used to hunt in Mars Hill at a place Nat and Becky's uncle owned, but some God-blessed idiot burned it down 2 summers ago. Drinking and then getting careless with the old smokes, that's what the fire marshal said, ain't they?"
Jonesy nodded.
"Not an uncommon story. The insurance paid the value of the place, but we had nowhere to hunt. I thought probably that'd be the end of it, and then Steve found this nice place over in Kineo. I think it's probably an unincorporated township, just another part of the Jefferson Tract. But Kineo's what they call it, the few people who live there. Do you know where I mean?"
"I know it," Jonesy said, speaking through lips that felt oddly numb.
He was getting another of those telephone calls from nowhere. Hole in the Wall was about 20 miles east of Goslin's. Kineo was maybe 30 miles to the west of the market. That was 50 miles in all. Was he supposed to believe that the man sitting on the couch with just his head sticking out of the down comforter had wandered 50 miles since becoming lost the previous afternoon? It was absurd. It was impossible.
"Smells good," McCarthy said.
And it did. But Jonesy no longer felt hungry. He was just bringing the chow over to the couch when he heard feet stamping on the stone outside the door. A moment later, the door opened and Beaver came in. Snow swirled around his legs in a dancing mist.
"Jesus Christ bananas," the Beav said.
Pete had once made a list of Beavisms, and Jesus Christ bananas was high on it, along with such standbys as doodly fuck and kiss my bender. They were exclamations both zen and profane.
"I thought I was going to end up spending the night out there, then I saw the light."
Beav raised his hands roofward, fingers spread.
"Seen the light, Lord, yes, sir, praise Jesus."
His glasses started to unfog then, and he saw the stranger on the couch. He lowered his hands, slowly, then smiled. That was one of the reasons Jonesy had loved him ever since grade school, although the Beav could be tiresome and wasn't the brightest bulb in the chandelier by any means. His first reaction to the unplanned and unexpected wasn't a frown, but a smile.
"Hi," he said. "I'm Joe Clarendon. Who are you?"
"Rick McCarthy," he said, and got to his feet.
The comforter tumbled off him, and Jonesy saw he had a pretty good pot belly pooching out the front of his sweater.
Well, he thought, nothing strange about that, at least. It's the middle-aged man's disease, and it's going to kill us in our millions during the next 20 years or so.
McCarthy stuck out his hand, started to step forward, and almost tripped over the fallen comforter. If Jonesy hadn't reached out and grabbed his shoulder, steadying him, McCarthy probably would have fallen forward, very likely cleaning out the coffee table on which the food was now set. Again, Jonesy was struck by the man's queer ungainliness. It made him think of himself a little that past spring, as he had learned to walk all over again. He got a closer look at the patch on the guy's cheek, and sort of wished he hadn't. It wasn't frostbite at all. It looked like a skin tumor of some kind, or perhaps a port wine stain with stubble growing out of it.
"Whoa, whoa, shake it, but don't break it," Beaver said, springing forward.
He grabbed McCarthy's hand and pumped it until Jonesy thought McCarthy would end up swan diving into the coffee table after all. He was glad when the Beav, all 5'6" of him with snow still melting into that long black hippie hair, stepped back. The Beav was still smiling, more broadly than ever. With the shoulder-length hair and the thick glasses, he looked either like a math genius or a serial killer. In fact, he was a carpenter.
"Ricky has had a time of it," Jonesy said. "Got lost yesterday and spent last night in the woods."
Beaver's smile stayed on, but became concerned. Jonesy had an idea what was coming next and willed Beaver not to say it. He had gotten the impression that McCarthy was a fairly religious man who might not care much for profanity. But of course, asking Beaver to clean up his mouth was like asking the wind not to blow.
"Bitch in a buzzsaw," he cried. "Now that's fucking terrible. Sit down. Eat. You too, Jonesy."
"Nah," Jonesy said. "You go on and eat that. You're the one who just came in out of the snow."
"You sure?"
"I am. I'll just scramble myself some eggs. Rick can catch you up on his story. Maybe it'll make more sense to you than it does to me, he thought.
Okay.
Beaver took off his jacket, red, and his vest, orange, of course. He started to toss them on the woodpile, then thought better of it.
Wait, got something you might want.
He stuck his hand deep into one of the pockets of his down jacket, rummaged, and came out with a paperback book, considerably bent, but seemingly none the worse for wear otherwise. Little devils with pitchforks danced across the cover. Small Vices by Robert Parker. It was the book Jonesy had been reading in the stand. The Beave held it out to him, smiling.
I left your sleeping bag, but I figured you wouldn't be able to sleep tonight unless you knew who the fuck done it.
You shouldn't have gone up there, Jonesy said. But he was touched in a way only Beaver could touch him. The Beave had come back through the blowing snow and hadn't been able to make out if Jonesy was up in the tree stand or not for sure. He could have called, but for the Beave, calling wasn't enough. Only seeing was believing.
Not a problem, Beaver said,
and sat down next to McCarthy, who was looking at him as a person might look at a new and rather exotic kind of small animal.
Well, thanks, Jonesy said. You get around that sandwich. I'm going to do eggs.
He started away, then turned around.
What about Pete and Henry? You think they'll make it back okay?
The Beave opened his mouth, but before he could answer, the wind gasped around the cabin again, making the walls creak and rising to a grim whistle around the eaves.
Oh, this is just a cap of snow, Beaver said when the gust died away. They'll make it back. Getting out again, if there comes a real norther, that might be a different story.
He began to gobble the grilled cheese sandwich. Jonesy went over to the kitchen to scramble some eggs and heat up another can of soup. He felt better about McCarthy now that Beaver was here. The truth was, he always felt better when the Beave was around. Crazy, but true. By the time he got the eggs scrambled and the soup hot, McCarthy was chatting away to Beaver as if the two of them had been friends for the last 10 years. If McCarthy was offended by the Beave's litany of mostly comic profanity, that was outweighed by Beave's considerable charm.
There's no explaining it, Henry had once told Jonesy. He's a tribble. That's all. You can't help liking him. It's why his bed is never empty. It sure isn't his looks women respond to.
Jonesy brought his eggs and soup into the living area, working not to limp. It was amazing how much more his hip hurt in bad weather. He had always thought that was an old wives' tale, but apparently it was not, and sat in one of the chairs at the end of the couch. McCarthy had been doing more talking than eating, it seemed. He'd barely touched his soup and had eaten only half of his grilled cheese.
How you boys doing? Jonesy asked.
He shook pepper onto his eggs and fell to with a will. His appetite had made a complete comeback, it seemed.
We're two happy whoremasters, Beaver said.
But although he sounded as chipper as ever, Jonesy thought he looked worried, perhaps even alarmed.
Rick's been telling me about his adventures. It's as good as a story in one of those men's magazines they had in the barbershop when I was a kid.
He turned back to McCarthy, still smiling. That was the Beave, always smiling, and flicked a hand through the heavy fall of his black hair.
Old man Castengay was the barber on our side of Derry when I was a kid, and he scared me so fucking bad with those clippers of his that I've been staying away from him ever since.
McCarthy gave a weak little smile but made no reply. He picked up the other half of his cheese sandwich, looked at it, and put it back down again. The red mark on his cheek glowed like a brand. Beaver, meanwhile, rushed on as if he was afraid of what McCarthy might say if given half a chance. Outside, it was snowing harder than ever, blowing, too, and Jonesy thought of Henry and Pete out there, probably on the deep-cut road by now in Henry's old scout.
Not only did Rick here just about get eaten up by something in the middle of the night, a bear he thinks it was, he lost his rifle, too, a brand-new Remington 3030. Fucking A, you won't never see that again, not a chance in 100,000.
I know, McCarthy said. The color was fading out of his cheeks again. That leaden look coming back in. I don't even remember when I put it down, or... There was a sudden, low, rasping noise, like a locust. Jonesy felt the hair on the back of his neck stiffen, thinking it was something caught in the fireplace chimney. Then he realized it was McCarthy. Jonesy had heard some loud farts in his time, some long ones, too, but nothing like this. It seemed to go on forever, although it couldn't have been more than a few seconds. Then the smell hit. McCarthy had picked up his spoon. Now he dropped it back into his barely touched soup and raised his right hand to his blemished cheek in an almost girlish gesture of embarrassment.
"Oh, gosh, I'm sorry," he said. "Not a bit more room out than there is in," Beaver said.
But that was just instinct running his mouth, instinct and the habits of a lifetime. Jonesy could see he was as shocked by that smell as Jonesy was himself. It wasn't the sulfurous, rotten egg odor that made you laugh and roll your eyes and wave your hand in front of your face, yelling, "Ah, Jesus, who cut the cheese?" Nor one of those methane swamp gas farts, either. It was the smell Jonesy had detected on McCarthy's breath, only stronger. A mixture of ether and overripe bananas, like the starter fluid you shot into your carburetor on a sub-zero morning.
"Oh, dear, that's awful," McCarthy said. "I am so darned sorry."
"It's all right, really," Jonesy said. But his stomach had curled up into a ball, like something protecting itself from assault. He wouldn't be finishing his own early lunch. No way in hell could he finish it. He wasn't prissy about farts as a rule, but this one really reeked. The Beeve got up from the couch and opened a window, letting in a swirl of snow and a draft of blessedly fresh air.
"Don't you worry about it, partner. But that is pretty ripe. What the hell you been eating, woodchuck turds? Bushes and moss and other stuff, I don't know just what," McCarthy said. "I was just so hungry, you know, I had to eat something, but I don't know much about that sort of thing. Never read any of those books by Ewell Gibbons. And of course it was dark."
He said this last almost as if struck by an inspiration, and Jonesy looked up at Beaver, catching his eye to see if the Beeve knew what Jonesy did. McCarthy was lying. McCarthy didn't know what he'd eaten in the woods, or if he'd eaten anything at all. He just wanted to explain that ghastly, unexpected frog's croak and the stench which had followed it. The wind gusted again, a big, gaspy whoop that sent a fresh skein of snow in through the open window, but at least it was turning the air over, and thank God for that. McCarthy leaned forward so suddenly he might have been propelled by a spring, and when he hung his head forward between his knees, Jonesy had a good idea of what was coming next. "So long, Navajo rug, it's been good to know you." The Beeve clearly thought the same. He pulled back his legs, which had been splayed out before him, to keep them from being splattered. But instead of vomit, what came out of McCarthy was a long, low buzz, the sound of a factory machine which has been put under severe strain. McCarthy's eyes bulged from his face like glass marbles, and his cheeks were so taut that little crescents of shadow appeared under the corners of his eyes. It went on and on, a rumbling, rasping noise, and when it finally ceased, the Jenny out back seemed far too loud. "I've heard some mighty belches, but that's the all-time blue ribbon winner," Beeve said. He spoke with quiet and sincere respect. McCarthy leaned back against the couch, eyes closing, mouth downturned in what Jonesy took for embarrassment, pain, or both. And once again he could smell that aroma of bananas and ether, a fermenting, active smell like something which has just started to go over.
"Oh, God, I am so sorry," McCarthy said without opening his eyes. "I've been doing that all day, ever since light, and my stomach hurts again."
Jonesy and the Beeve shared a silent, concerned look.
"You know what I think?" Beaver asked. "I think you need to lie down and take you a little sleep. You were probably awake all night listening to that pesky bear and God knows what else. You're tired out and stressed out and fuck-a-duck knows what else out. You just need some shut-eye. A few hours, you'll be as right as the goddamn rain."
McCarthy looked at Beaver with such wretched gratitude that Jonesy felt a little ashamed to be seeing it. Although McCarthy's complexion was still leaden, he had begun to break a sweat, great big beads that formed on his brow and temples and then ran down his cheeks like clear oil. This in spite of the cold air now circulating in the room.
"You know," he said, "I bet you're right. I'm tired. That's all it is. My stomach hurts, but that part's just stress. And I was eating all sorts of things, bushes and just, gosh, oh dear, I don't know, all sorts of things."
He scratched his cheek. Is this darn thing on my face bad? Is it bleeding? No, Jonesy said, just red.
It's a reaction, McCarthy said dolefully. I get the same thing from peanuts. I'll lie down. That's the ticket, all right.
He got to his feet, then tottered. Beaver and Jonesy both reached for him, but McCarthy steadied on his feet before either of them could take hold. Jonesy could have sworn that what he had taken for a middle-aged potbelly was almost gone. Was it possible? Could the man have passed that much gas? He didn't know. All he knew for sure was that it had been a mighty fart and an even mightier belch, the sort of thing you could yarn on for 20 years or more, starting off, "We used to go up to Beaver Clarendon's camp the first week of hunting season every year, and one November, it was 01, the year of the big fall storm, this fellow wandered into camp." Yes, it would make a good story. People would laugh about the big fart and the big burp. People always laughed at stories about farts and burps. He wouldn't tell the part about how he had come within 8 ounces of press on a Garand's trigger of taking McCarthy's life, though. No, he wouldn't want to tell that part, would he? Pete and Henry were doubling, and so Beaver led McCarthy to the other downstairs bedroom, the one Jonesy had been using. The Beav shot him a little apologetic look, and Jonesy shrugged. It was the logical place, after all. Jonesy could double in with Beav tonight. Christ knew they'd done it enough as kids, and in truth, he wasn't sure McCarthy could have managed the stairs anyway. He liked the man's sweaty, leaden look less and less. Jonesy was the sort of man who made his bed and then buried it. Books, papers, clothes, bags, assorted toiletries. He swept all this off as quick as he could, then turned back the coverlet. "You need to take a squirt, partner?" the Beav asked. McCarthy shook his head. He seemed almost hypnotized by the clean blue sheet Jonesy had uncovered. Jonesy was once again struck by how glassy the man's eyes were, like the eyes of a stuffed trophy head. Suddenly, and unbidden, he saw his living room back in Brookline, that upscale municipality next door to Boston. Braided rugs, early American furniture, and McCarthy's head mounted over the fireplace. "Bag that one up in Maine," he would tell his guests at cocktail parties. "Big bastard, dressed out at 170. He closed his eyes, and when he opened them, the Beav was looking at him with something like alarm. "Twinge in the hip," he said. "Sorry." "Mr. McCarthy, Rick, you'll want to take off your sweater and pants. Boots, too, of course." McCarthy looked around at him like a man roused from a dream. "Sure," he said, "you bet." "Need help?" Beaver asked. "No, gosh, no." McCarthy looked alarmed or amused or both. "I'm not that far gone." "Then I'll leave Jonesy to supervise." Beaver slipped out, and McCarthy began to undress, starting by pulling his sweater off over his head. Beneath it, he wore a red and black hunter's shirt, and beneath that, a thermal undershirt. And yes, there was less gut poking out the front of that shirt, Jonesy was sure of it. Well, almost sure. Only an hour ago, he reminded himself, he had been sure McCarthy's coat was the head of a deer. McCarthy sat down in the chair beside the window to take off his shoes, and when he did, there was another fart, not as long as the first one, but just as loud and hoarse. Neither of them commented on it, or the resulting smell, which was strong enough in the little room to make Jonesy's eyes feel like watering. McCarthy kicked his boots off. They made clunking sounds on the wooden floor, then stood up and unbuckled his belt. As he pushed his blue jeans down, revealing the lower half of his thermal underwear, the Beav came back in with a ceramic pot from upstairs. He put it down by the head of the bed. "Just in case you have to, you know, irk. Or if you get one of those collect calls you just have to take right away." McCarthy looked at him with a dullness Jonesy found alarming. A stranger in what had been his bedroom, somehow ghostly in his baggy long underwear. An ill stranger. The question was, just how ill? "In case you just can't make the bathroom," the Beav explained. "Which, by the way, is close by. Just bang a left outside the bedroom door, but remember it's the second door as you go along the wall, okay? If you forget and go in the first one, you'll be taking a shit in the linen closet." Jonesy was surprised into a laugh and didn't care for the sound of it in the slightest, high and slightly hysterical. "I feel better now," McCarthy said.
But Jonesy detected absolutely zero sincerity in the man's voice. And the guy just stood there in his underwear, like an android whose memory circuits have been about three-quarters erased. Before, he had shown some life, if not exactly vivacity. Now, that was gone, like the color in his cheeks. "Go on, Rick," Beaver said quietly. "Lie down and catch some winks. Work on getting your strength back." "Yes, okay."